Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 271. Welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Tirullo. I serve as a pastor of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Countryside, Illinois. And with me, literally with me, in my study, in the studio, Studio B, is Rob McKenzie. Rob serves as an elder with me at Westminster. Hey, Rob. I don't know what, I just like went blank.
So, the fact that I'm actually here.
Yes, in your presence, blowing my mind.
I have that effect on people. You know. we wanted to actually get a recording done that we could actually put out.
Yes.
And our community, me being down in my southern palatial estate, you know, which is just so vast.
With the moat.
Yes. With the moat. Mm-hmm. I think maybe, you know, it's just hard for internet to penetrate.
The force field you have around.
That's very true. That is very true. And so I've actually ventured out into the outside world.
Yes.
So that we could actually
get a recording in. Yeah. So we decided to do this one in person and see what happens. So it looks like this should be okay without any reverb or any static, or I don't know what all the things we had. Last one we didn't even put out. It was reverb all over the place.
Yeah, it was me talking and repeating myself, which I know is something I need to work on. But
yeah, it sounds normal, but you know,
I was repeating myself to myself. But personally, I blame Hawaii.
You blame Hawaii?
Yeah, just causing the interruption in our schedule. I just blame the whole state.
The whole state. So if we do have any listeners in Hawaii, brethren, I don't blame you. It's Rob. So yeah. Don't welcome into your state whenever he decides to visit someday.
Well, it's because...
Look, it's Rob. Really, no.
I'll probably...
Pandemic protocols.
My picture of pandemic. Pandemic's over for 10 years. Not for you.
Not for you,
not
Rob.
Not for you. We were doing well, and then you went away to Hawaii.
It must be my fault. It's always my fault.
That's right.
I don't have
finally
a
for just right out there admitting it, not arguing with me.
It's best not to.
So yes. We are going to once again talk about the communicable attributes.
Well, once again, talk about the attributes of God.
Right.
This time, the communicable. Last time, the incommunicable.
Yes.
Correct.
Right.
That is
correct. Except for the last time that we didn't get to put that
out. Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes. So, yes, last time, but you don't know about this audience.
That's right.
We did start to talk about the communicable attributes, but now we're going to continue that conversation.
That's right. But look at the dedication that I have. I mean, I came all the way here to...
Wouldn't take about an hour?
I had to get... It did. Well, of course, I also came at rush hour.
Yeah.
yeah, Chicago traffic. It's fun.
Yay.
But I had to get through the Beast, mm-hmm. who I will say was so excited to actually see me because I hadn't been here in a while.
You haven't been here forever to record.
She was almost like vibrating out of her skin. It was really kind of funny.
She does the waggle.
She does.
So it's the Beast waggle. It's as though when she moves her body, her back end almost touches her head. She waggles so much.
Sure, sure, sure.
I mean, she definitely does it with her tail.
Yeah.
Her tail makes it all the way around. And if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, that tail can just knock you over.
That is very true. She's 70 feet high. I mean, that's just how it works. I think the Beast Waggle was a minor hit in 1962.
The Beast Waggle.
The Beast Waggle, yeah.
Yeah, no, she's a great dog.
She is very, very
if you can get by
excitable.
Her,
yeah.
Then
yeah.
she accepts
I did make
you.
It. Finally made it down here.
Yeah. It's good to see the Beast again. Have the Beast mentioned in the podcast. It's been too long.
Yeah, yeah.
We've heard people say, I miss the Beast. Where's the Beast? I should have like a bark, you know, and every time we mention something, we can have her bark. Like the Machin Horn.
Oh, the Machin Horn. Yeah, that's good.
If you don't know the Machin Horn, the Machin Horn is from, goodness, what's that?
Presbycast?
Oh, Presbycast. Sorry, guys. I haven't looked at their stuff in a long time. Sorry, it was a lot of guys, you know, following up on the on the PCA yeah. General Assembly, and I just lost interest after a little bit.
Well, because you went to Hawaii.
I did. I went to Hawaii, and I lost interest in all things.
Everyone, and he came back, and it's like, you know that you're the pastor of this church, and you went, what?
What church?
What
no,
are you talking
about? No, that is not the case.
Who are you?
It does take a little bit of time to sort of get acclimated back into regular life,
though. It's like when Gandalf came back as Gandalf the White. He had been gone for... His time was just eons, and he just had to have everything
really?
Brought back to him. Yeah.
So my time in Hawaii was like fighting the Balrog, falling down a bottomless
no,
pit.
It was being dead after you died fighting the Balrog. That's what it was like.
Well, now I'm resurrected then, I guess, as Bob the White. Is that what you're saying?
I had not gone that far in my head,
but I like it. You like it? I'm not Bob White. I'm Bob the White. And you are Rob the Gray. Are you still Rob the Gray?
Oh, yeah, actually. Silver Fox. So,
well, yeah. Salt and pepper. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Back to Burkhoff.
Back to Burkhoff. Oh, goodness. Right. Sorry, friends. It has been a while, a few weeks there, so we apologize. And here we go. We are back to chapter 4, The Attributes of God. Number 2, the communicable attributes.
Yeah. So I think, you know, we often, for most Sunday school classes, if you were to get up and say, okay, we're going to talk about the communicable attributes of God, I think people, if they hadn't heard that term before, which...
It's possible.
It's sure. Very possible, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that they might get this glazed look in their eyes of like, oh, great. You know, now we're going to talk theology and the communicable attributes of God. Can't we just read the Bible and not worry about, you know, those ivory tower kind of seminary terms and everything?
Sure, yeah.
And I understand that. I mean, there are pastors that or teachers in Sunday school that do overplay some of that stuff and because they're geeked out about it. Mm-hmm. And they think that everybody else is geeked out about it. But the thing is about the communicable attributes is it's much more than just understanding about the characteristics that God has given to us that we bear in part, that he bears as a whole. It also shows the special relationship that God has with us, his people.
Yeah.
We are created to be in communion with him in such a way that we actually reflect certain characteristics that are, you know, the animals don't reflect these things. God didn't communicate because these attributes, because this is in connection with the image of God within us. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really important for us to understand that the image that God has placed within us that allow us to have wisdom and love and even certain power or sovereignty and in the parameters that God has given us that it's for a purpose and one of the main purposes is that we might have greater communion with God.
Yeah, I think that's right, Rob. And when begin this discussion of the communicable attributes of God, those ones that have some traces or resemblance in man, that's the language that Burkhoff uses, it's typically done from a description of the attributes of God. So we might look at these and say, okay, I'm not exactly sure how that might communicate or be in man or in what regard does that translate over to man. But we can talk about that. But the point of the language here and under the attributes of God, we're not talking about the theology of man at this point. We're still talking about the theology of God underneath that subject heading of attributes that are found in man as well in some measure in a limited, finite fashion. what are these attributes in God? And that's how we're looking at them from God's perspective as best as we're able to from his word. So like the first one that Burkhoff deals with is the knowledge of God. And so in talking about the knowledge of God, we're talking about and this is to quote him, that perfection of God, whereby he, in a manner all his own, knows himself and all things possible and actual. Now, that's not how man knows. So we're not talking about it from man's perspective. We're talking about it. How does this relate to God knowledge? So that's how we're coming at this by way of its subject matter. But then when you reflect upon it, and I think that this is what you were doing, Rob, when you reflect upon it, you see the relationship between man and God and the image-bearing aspects of it. You see how God created man in order to be in communion with God by having and giving us some of his attributes in limited, finite, creaturely manner. And that's what we just need to. So when we're talking about knowledge of God and we talk about it in his perfect knowledge and all things possible and actual, that's not how it is in man. Mm-hmm. That's just to set that out there at the beginning, right?
Right. The knowledge that we've been given, the knowledge that we have of God is been given to us. Burkhoff brings that out, that he talks about God doesn't have knowledge of himself that has come to him from outside of himself, but we do.
Right, yes.
The knowledge that we have of God came to us. And so this, you know, we go to Romans 1, and if we hadn't sinned, if we had no sin, the knowledge of God would be free within our lives to help us understand who he is, how we should live, and we would know that exactly as he would want us to know that. But our sin takes that knowledge of God, and again, Romans 1, it talks about how mankind, because mankind hates God, unregenerate man, that they take that knowledge and they fight against it. Mm-hmm. There's a war within all people of not just knowledge that there is a God, but that there's knowledge that there is the God. And it's fighting with sin, the sin nature. And this is, in one sense, how you can have people who are not converted, and yet you talk to them and they'll talk about, you know, oh, I believe there's a God. And the more you talk to them, you think, man, my goodness, they're so close to Christianity and what they're saying. Because for them, their sin has not wiped out that the knowledge that's within them to the point as it has in other people. They actually are gaining a lot from the knowledge that is within them, and the way that they can describe God, the way that they understand God, that is almost like somebody's that's converted. What we're also told, of course, Romans 1 goes to the other extreme, where people are engaged in sin and sinfulness, and they actually take that knowledge that's fighting within them and they squish it. They just—it's almost as if it's completely gone. Now it's not completely gone, and it leaves them without excuse. It's not like they can stand before God someday and say, "Well, I didn't know. I didn't know that you existed. I didn't know that you were my creator." No, that knowledge in and of itself is actually in them. It leaves them without excuse. But people can sin to a place where the sinful war that's going on with them that against this knowledge, it's almost as if it's won completely.
Well, it's the language of God handing them over, right? Giving people over, or their consciences being seared so much that it's just, you know, hardened, you know, just so hardened. I think that's what you're getting at, that type of thing. Yeah. But for humans, this knowledge is there, right? And it's suppressed in unrighteousness. That's the language of Romans 1. And that's useful for us to know that. Now, we're not, like God, omniscient.
Right.
That's the language of of the knowledge of God is omniscience. He knows all things, past, present, future. He's not bound by time. the time that we are. We are temporal beings. That's what a finite being is, right? And so his knowledge is a different kind of knowledge. It is a creator knowledge, a divine knowledge. It is different. And so it's just helpful to put that out there as a category, that God's knowledge is categorically different than human beings' knowledge. Mm. It's not just a matter of an amount of knowledge or all knowledge, and we just have some knowledge, but we are creaturely knowledge. His right. is divine knowledge. So two different types of knowledge, although similar.
Yeah, it's almost like you're saying that there's a distinction between the creator and the creature.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, it's analogous in that regard.
Yeah,
right?
Write that one down.
Yeah.
The next one.
Yeah, go ahead.
This one's interesting because it's wisdom, mm-hmm. that God is, just as he has complete knowledge, he also has complete wisdom, and Burkhoff is saying that the God's wisdom is an aspect of his knowledge. God didn't learn how to become wise. God has always been wise. The knowledge that he has is always perfectly wise. And we gain that. Mm-hmm. We have knowledge of something, and sometimes we can fail. And even in that failure, we gain wisdom.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we have knowledge, facts, information, right? We have we might then have an understanding of those facts and that information, but then it's sort of, I think it's often maybe put it in this terms, the application of that knowledge and understanding then mm-hmm. is wisdom. And sometimes experience helps right. with that understanding for us in our temporal, and then sometimes, like you said, that failure of the application at first mm-hmm. can lead to wisdom, or that failure of understanding right. can lead to wisdom.
Well, this is the child with the hot pan on the stove, and you're saying to them, "That's hot. Don't touch that. It will burn you." Mm-hmm. And they're looking at you, and they say, "Okay, I know what hot is. I know what burn is. I know what touch is. And I'm being told not to do that because it is this, mm-hmm. and it will." The consequences will be this.
Yes.
And then, of course, they touch it.
Yeah. Well, now they have understanding.
Yeah. Now they
now
have
the question is if they have wisdom not to do it again.
Correct. Correct. But most children gain that wisdom. Mm-hmm. Most, you know, I do remember being about 2 and a half and sticking my finger in the outlet.
You did.
I did.
How'd that feel?
Once. I did it once.
Did it once.
Well, it felt, shocking. And, sorry, pun intended. It did. It was to the point where that whole room, everything in that room, everything that was happening in that room is seared into my memory. Mm. I will
literally.
Always, yes, it really was.
It's now just, we understand lots of things about you now, Rob.
Oh, that's just the beginning. I got plenty of other stuff. But I only did it once because it really hurt.
Sorry. Just
I was 2 and a half.
Just imagine little Robbie and his hair, like just like standing on whatever hair he had at 2 and a half.
That's pretty true. That's pretty true. I've got some. Well, the problem with me is that my hair has always been thick. It always grows very, very quickly. So I get a haircut and then my hair grows fast. And my mom was an Elvis fan. So I have some pictures as a child in some very interesting leisure type suits with quite the hair. I just look at it.
We need again, to put pics up on
makes,
the website.
It makes you wonder why I was sticking my finger in a light socket.
Oh, goodness.
But that is, but see, that's
which
the thing.
Which is next, the goodness
but
of God.
It is the goodness. But just sticking with wisdom.
Yes, yes.
Is that. God created us with knowledge of him, but also with the ability to gain understanding, to gain knowledge, to learn, and to, again, in our unfallen state, we still would have been doing trial and error when it comes to, but it would have been completely devoid of the curse. It would have been completely devoid of sin. But we still would have learned. We still would have gained that wisdom. So it doesn't have to be the finger in a light socket or touching a hot pan. Wisdom can be gained also in ways that are not like harmful. But this is, but again, God created us to be like this. He wants us to seek after wisdom, and especially the wisdom of God.
Yeah, and just before we leave this this particular topic, I like reading what Berkhof has by way of his own definitions for these things, just to have them set before us and to have those categories for our listeners. He says, wisdom is, it is the virtue of God, which manifests itself in the selection of worthy ends and in the choice of the best means for the realization of those ends. Mm. So you get a sense there of not only does he know and choose the end, but he chooses the best way to get there. Now, if we think about that in terms of our lives, that's a very hard thing for us to submit to, because that means that for believers whose end is glory and blessing, that the things that we're going through in life is something that God has in his wisdom had for us. Mm-hmm. And that's the best way, the most wise way to accomplish his means in us. And that's a hard thing for us to accept.
It is.
As believers, because of the hard things that we go through, in all sorts of various ways that I'm sure our listeners can relate to.
Yeah. I think just rabbit trailing with you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reason why it's so hard at times is because, we look at it as, all things work together for good to those who love God. And those, yes, you're going through a hard time right now, but God is going to bring good from that and for your good. And there are reasons why these things are happening in your life. And you need to submit. You need to be at peace with what God is bringing you through. But we know that we don't deserve God's love. We don't deserve his favor. And so when we're going through bad things, it's easy to think, well, I don't deserve good things from God. So to grasp on to the finality that is good, looking at it in the future, saying, okay, I know that God is leading me to what is good, I should grasp that. But sometimes all we can think of is, I don't deserve that good. And so the times of trouble that I'm enduring, if they were to last the rest of my life, I couldn't complain. And so to grasp that, well, wait, but no, just be patient, because God is going to bring some good from this. What if he doesn't? In from a human point of view.
Right, right. In this life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that's what can be hard to live through.
Well, yeah, it's all can be hard to live through. I mean, the various frustrations of life on this earth that are many for the human experience, and they can be severe, right? I'm persecuted brethren throughout the history of the world. Yeah. And they can be lighter and just plain confusing.
Yes.
Right? I don't understand why these circumstances are happening and how they can be for your glory or my blessing in the end. And therefore it just confusing and hard. And that's what makes it hard to bend the knee, so to speak, submit and still worship in the midst of those circumstances. So, but that's what God calls us to, right? And to live life without complaint, which is hard, right? Cause we're we're prone to that. So it's a hard thing. And then, wisdom was, just a little teeny paragraph, and goodness is only a few more lines, but he moves from knowledge to wisdom to goodness. And this goes to something we say a lot at our congregation: God is good.
Yeah.
I hope a lot of people say that, because we need to remember it,
Right.
Because all of these things we just talked about in the wisdom of God, his purposes are good. And to put this, sort of front load this by way of definition instead of on the back end, it's that perfection which prompts him to deal kindly and bounteously with all his creatures. So here he's referring to God being good to all mankind. And to a certain extent, right? I mean, not to a certain extent. This is, we're called to this, right? As much as you are able, live at peace with all men.
Yeah.
All right. How do you do that? We have to have a sense of goodness, of being good with other people, kind and generous to other people.
We are commanded to do good to all, especially those of the household of faith.
Yes.
And
that's a good qualification.
Right. Remember. And it's...
But not to the neglect of others. Go ahead. Sorry.
Right. No, but but again, you know, as you referred to, this is talking about this is talking about a moral quality, the holiness of God. This is talking about the goodness of God. This is a moral statement. And so when we do good things, we're doing righteous acts. We can only do those things if we do them in faith as righteous acts. And so God, of course, we were created holy. We were created righteous. And we have to remember that through our salvation, the Holy Spirit is progressively sanctifying us, creating holiness in our lives that we might be able to do good to all.
Yeah.
We don't have that capability before we are converted. It's impossible because unless it's done in faith, it's sin. Mm-hmm. So we look at people that are not Christians that do what we would say, well, those are righteous acts, and they're doing them. Yes, but they're doing them in sin. They're not doing them for the glory of God. They're not doing them in faith. And therefore, there's no righteousness being done. There's no holiness in those acts. I'm glad that those acts are being done because perhaps people are benefiting from them. But that's why we have to remember that the goodness here is talking about a moral, the moral character of God, and to a degree, the moral character of us.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about here as doing well unto others. And that's the language he uses. And what you get then is you think of passages where, God is just letting things rain on the righteous and the unrighteous.
Right.
So that the righteous and the unrighteous can grow food and trade and eat and live, which gives opportunity for the gospel to go out and for those people to receive the gospel or those people to persecute those who are preaching the gospel. I mean, there's all, that goodness of God allows for so much to occur in this world that we don't even think about.
Yeah. It's interesting how he goes, because he sets it up as the moral, this goodness, almost as a the totality of God's character, that his nature in and of itself is good. Because then he goes down, of course, again, remember, these are communicable attributes. So again, we've been created righteous, we've been created good. Not the same goodness as God, because we were mutable and God is not. But then he comes into the love of God as the next communicable attribute. But he says love, grace, mercy, long-suffering. It's almost as if he's opening up the category of goodness and now looking into that category and seeing these subcategories as love, grace, mercy, long-suffering.
Yeah, I mean, it appears, I mean, he doesn't actually do it as subcategories, but we sometimes think of it in those terms. And he does deal with love next, right? The love of God. So the love of God, often, right, the one attribute of God that is most often cited, right? If it's not God is good,
right?
God is love.
Right.
God is love. That's what you're going to get more often than not from. And if God is love, then how can all these other bad things happen? Right.
There's more bumper stickers that have sold that say God is love
than any in the world.
Than says God is my co-pilot.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I hope so.
All right. Well, if all of a sudden the beast has gone outside and started barking. So if you hear the beast in the background, my apologies.
Yes, that is exactly what happened, because I can see the beast through the window.
Can you see the beast through the window? The beast is trying to break through the window to get at Rob.
I think that is what's going on.
All right, love of God.
Yeah, I think, this is, and again, going back to the, when we talk about goodness, we talk about, well, God is good. Yes, God is good. But if I were to say, hey, did you listen to that album that I lent you? Yeah, it was good. that doesn't sound like you really cared. You'll never listen to it again if you gave me that answer. we just, it's just the way our language is that we use the word good. But it's the same thing with love. I love ice cream.
You know, I love my dog.
Yeah, there you go.
I love my wife. Yeah. I'm using that word love in very different ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so when we talk about God being love and then creating us and communicating that attribute to us, so therefore we have the capacity to love. And before the fall, there was, between Adam and Eve, there was perfect love. Between Adam and Eve and all of creation, Adam loved the creation that God had made. And that is a reflection on God's attribute of love. But today, in our language, in our society, mm-hmm. both good, love, we almost have to stop and think, okay, what does that really mean? Every time we hear it, what does that really mean? That God is good. What does that really mean, that God is love? Am I understanding that right? Just because those words have become desensitized as far as the power that should be in them. I'm not saying it's we've done anything wrong. It's just the nature of our language. But it is saying so much more than I think we can really understand, because our language has watered down those words so much.
Yeah, and Burkhoff even kind of, I don't know if he's getting at that, but you know, he deals with the love of God in this alongside of grace, mercy, and long suffering. He puts them all in the same paragraph when he is here looking at the love of God. He says that it might be considered in various points of view. All right, so he puts it this way. The unmerited love of God, which reveals itself in pardoning sin, is called his grace. That love relieving the misery of those who are bearing the consequences of sin is known as his mercy or tender compassion. And when it bears with the sinner who does not heed the instructions and warnings of God, it is named his long-suffering or forbearance, or we've said, I think, patience is another way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So he's saying, you know, love maybe in different contexts is shown in mercy, in compassion, in grace, in patience, in this type of way, in these this fashion, which is a way of doing it, right? It's a way of looking at this, right? God is love, and this is how his love is expressed in mercy, in his patience, in his grace, his unmerited favor, in saving a people for himself. So I think that's a possible way of getting one's head around the concept of that, or not the concept, the attribute that is being expressed here. You also get the sense of, you know, what is love, and you hear the language, you know, of course, well, what is love? Well, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes on him should not perish but have everlasting life, or that one would die for another out of love, a self-sacrifice, right? So you have those other aspects of what love can be expressed.
So with Burkhoff, he keeps going, and in the communicable attributes, I mean, he talks about, again, you know, he talks about love, you know, grace, mercy, long suffering. These are aspects of characteristics that he's given to us. And as Christians, we always have to remember that through the Holy Spirit, we are capable, again, of pleasing God by loving others, by being gracious to others, by having mercy on others, by being long suffering with others, that by doing this, we are acting in a way that God has created us to act, that we are glorifying God because we are exercising the very nature that God has created us to hold. And, you know, Burkhoff takes this into God's holiness, talks about the holiness, and he stresses the fact that holiness is this, you know, complete freedom from error or sin. God is perfect. There's no sin. There's no, you know, it's not as if we as people, because we fail each other, we fail ourselves, we fail God. We look at others, even those who we trust the most, who we love the most, who we depend upon the most, and at some point, that person has probably failed us. And so while we still love them and we depend on them and we trust them and we confide in them, in the back of our minds, there's still that they could fail me. They could betray me. And even if it's somebody that, they personally haven't betrayed you, they haven't harmed you in any way, but somebody else did. Somebody else that you were a good friend with, that you were close with, they completely betrayed you. And now, trusting other people the way you had is very hard to do. But it's because we are still in that simultaneously sinner and saint state. But our eternity and the eternal state that God had created us to be in is one where we are only acting in a way that is holy, that we are without sin, that we don't fail anybody, and other people don't fail us. Other people don't sin against us. So we can, we were talking before the podcast, we were talking about living in a the now and the not yet, mm-hmm. You know, and how we have a foretaste of what that eternal glory will be like. Mm-hmm. And we have to remember that's not something that we should take for granted. We do have that foretaste. We can act righteously. We can love others. We can do these things, and we should strive to do them more.
And this holiness that we're talking about, the holiness of God, while it has that being free from moral imperfections, free from sin, and being morally perfect, as you were just talking about, Rob, and how that, you know, works itself over into mankind and how it communicates to us and the communicable attributes aspect of this. There's the other aspect of holiness, and that is that God is distinct, in fact, absolutely distinct from all of his creatures and exalted above them in infinite majesty, as Burkhoff puts it. He is holy. He is, we sometimes talk about that in terms of, you know, ceremonial objects of the Old Testament being holy. That is, they are set apart. He's different. He's distinct, absolutely distinct. Again, we've talked about this in a certain sense. He's creator, divine. We're creature, finite, and not divine. So there's that distinction, and holiness gets at that. And the objective and the sense of our being, God is holy in his being. He is wholly distinct. Now, how does that translate then over to mankind? Now, humanity. Well, there is a sense in which we are saints. You referenced the already, not yet, right? Mm-hmm. In the already aspect of this, we are set apart, mm-hmm. called out saints. Set apart as a distinct people. Now, we're not absolutely distinct as God is, because we're still human beings like other human beings, even fallen human beings, or even unbelieving human beings is what I meant to say. We're still fallen. but we're still set apart and holy, right? I mean, even we're told that the children of believers are holy, right? Paul tells us that. So there's a holiness and a set apartness, a distinctness that believers have that is akin to God, but not completely, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's different as well. And it's good to maintain that, understand that distinction that we have. We are set apart. That's why, you know, believers are not meant to marry unbelievers, because right. There's a distinction between the two.
Right.
There's a difference. One is holy and one is not. And you're not meant to intermingle in that regard. So it's just, I think that's a helpful aspect of the holiness of God that we ought to maintain and understand as well.
So Burkhoff moves, he talks about the righteousness of God. And of course, again, we you know, we've already talked about that God has created us as holy. He's created us righteous. He created us to do good things, to act in certain ways. And one of the things I found very interesting in Burkhoff talking about the righteousness of God is I think it can be helpful. And I remember actually Ian Wright and I talking about this years and years and years ago. I thought this was very interesting the way that he put it, where God in his holiness, this is so hard to explain. I'm not going to do it justice. But God chooses in creating us holy and righteous because he is holy and righteous, that he blesses us. That's God's reaction to his creatures who are holy and righteous. But God's reaction, and again, using the word reaction is not the right word. It's just hard with human language to really even get there.
Okay.
But because God doesn't react like we react. But the state of being of those who are sinful, it is God judges. In other words, you can never come to a place where God is just going to forgive because. That if there are sinners, you know, if you sin in one area, you've broken the whole law, right? Mm-hmm. Because God is righteous, because God is holy. And so here you are in his presence and now you have sinned. Now you are depraved and you are under his judgment. Now God can delay that judgment as he does. But what are we told? That God, in delaying his judgment for those who are still sinning, are incurring greater and greater wrath. God must judge sin. Why? Because he's sinless, he's holy, and he's righteous. So he must judge sin, which is why, in order for us to obtain salvation, that judgment, that wrath, has to be endured by someone, that has to be given. So Christ on the cross takes our wrath upon himself. The punishment for our sin is taken upon Christ because it must be given out. God must punish for sin because otherwise he ceases to be holy and righteous and good. Even, I mean, all these, he ceases to be God if he doesn't judge sin. In the same way, because God is holy, for those of us who are now holy through Christ, we are now righteous. God will bless us because his nature blesses his creatures who are holy and righteous.
Yeah, and the next attribute that Burkhoff brings to our attention is the truthfulness or the veracity of God. He calls it the perfection of God in virtue of which he is true in his inner being, in his revelation, and in his relation to his people. So, in essence, everything he does in truth, because it is within his inner being, right? There's no ability to lie, or there's no deceit in his communication of himself to others, to his people, in his revelation of himself, whether it be through the created order or through a written revelation or the various ways and diverse manners in which God revealed himself in the Old Testament. And that is because he is true in his inner being. Burkhoff continues to say, he says, he is the true God over against the idols, false, right? Knows things as they really are, and is faithful in the fulfillment of his promises. Interesting, he puts almost the faithfulness of God underneath the truthfulness of God, right?
Right.
So because God is true, there is this veracity of God. Every promise he has ever made,
right,
he must be faithful to it. Right?
Right,
because he is true to his promises. That's the faithfulness of God. We know the faithfulness of God much more than we know. We know God is true, right? Truth, Mm-hmm. Or we talk, you know, worship God in spirit and truth. We think of it in sort of general terms like that. But I'm not sure how often we relate that truthfulness of God to his faithfulness. That, okay, God can't tell a lie, therefore he's faithful. Mm. Right. That, right. Great is his faithfulness. We often sing. We don't often think of it in terms of his truthfulness. Right. Mm. But I think that works out really well to think of it in those terms to aid in our being blessed by his fulfillment of promises as being a truthful God, a faithful God.
Right. I mean, God says, I will never leave you. God says that he will never lose us. Mm-hmm. And because he is true, because he is faithful, those will always happen. God will not lose us.
I will never forsake you.
Right. He will not forsake it. That will always be true because God ceases to be God if he forsakes us.
Yeah. Thinking of it in terms of what you just said, he ceases to be God, right? And and God can't cease to be God, right? Because of these other attributes about him. He cannot not be. And if he therefore violates one of these aspects of himself as he revealed himself, then he cannot not be. Therefore, he can't violate these things, right? And it's just it can get mind-boggling as you try to, you know, think about it in our finite minds.
It is. That's why, you know, I even struggle with the language. We all struggle with the language to describe God.
Yeah.
And,
you know, which is why you have big books written about one subject of these things.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. And, you know, Burkhoff's next attribute he talks about is sovereignty. God is sovereign over all things. And he communicates that to us by making us co-regents. What did he tell Adam? He said, tend the garden, subdue the earth. Adam is given authority over animals. He's given authority. When it talks about Adam naming the animals, it's good to have, again, our language can be a bit watered down when we think of words, but that idea of naming is much more, it has to do with authority than it has to do with just, you know, oh, those are cats. Those are, you know, the naming actually is part of the authority. It is demonstrating sovereignty to name something. And so Adam, by doing that he names all the animals, it is demonstrating an act of sovereignty. God has said to him, here is the domain that I've given you, and you are to be faithful in fulfilling what I've commanded you to do. And then we see Adam being faithful and fulfilling in a sovereign way over the animals, being faithful to God in what he gave him to do.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it comes to our last, I want to go to our last communicable attribute. And it's interesting to me that Burkhoff has it listed out in the big bold letters.
Mm-hmm. Like everything else.
Like everything else. And it says omnipotence. I'm not sure if he meant to say what he think he's saying. It's really interesting because we're not omnipotent, and this is supposed to be, you know, maybe he should have said nipotence.
Right. Well, or just power. Right.
Oh, power. Sure.
Right. But. Right. I mean, sovereignty and power, they go together, right? Because the other, so he's not giving us two different ones here, sovereignty and omnipotence, whether or not that was the right one to use in this category, because that does not communicate to us in the sense of omnipotence, all powerful, but he is trying to communicate a sense of the ability to exercise power or some sense of authority or sovereignty. God certainly has that in the omni sense, right? And in the all powerful, all sovereign sense, we have it in a limited, finite power or even ability to exercise a will. So at the beginning of this section, he says, you know, this is considered in two different points. That is his sovereign will and sovereign power. And under sovereign power, that's where he calls it omnipotence. So it's the exercise of power, exercise of will is what we're getting at here. God has the ability, or God has the attribute of exercise, right? He spoke and it exists, right? So that's the exercise of his will,
right?
Is right. There's no thwarting it. There's no changing it. That he does and he exercises that authority with right. all power and all sovereignty.
So Adam is given the authority over
creation. It's a derivative authority, right? It's a delegated authority, and he has it. Yes.
But it's the power that we see him exercising.
Yes, in naming animals, right.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh. Oh, don't do this to me, Rob. You're going to do it to me, whatever it is, yes.
Can God do all things?
He can do all things according to his will.
Okay.
Yes. See, Rob. Yeah.
You figured out my
yes, I'm so smart. Not.
Because Berghoff talks about this.
He does talk about it. It must have been a problem that kids were having or something at that time and were struggling with this particular question. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, you know, the thought question of how many angels can fit on the head of a pin is a real thought question from medieval.
Right.
You know, I mean, people did get, can God lift a rock? Can God create a rock too big for him to lift?
Right.
Because, you know, what's the paradox there? Either he can't create a rock big enough that he can't lift, or that, so it's his ability to create, or he doesn't have the ability to create, or
doesn't have the power to draw.
You know, it's we're always trying to figure out, but God is not bound to our logical paradoxes. it's we get to the point where we want to come up with ways that we can limit God. And I think some of it's innocent. I think some of it is just thought, you know, thinking, hey, I wonder, can God, what about this? You know, just the, you know, and the angels on the head of pin, it has to do with spatial. Mm-hmm. You know, is God limited to how many angels can fit on the head? Is God limited to his spatial boundaries?
Yeah.
That kind of a thing.
I mean, Berghoff does bring out, right, the Bible teaches us that there are things God cannot do.
Right.
Right? So in that sense, omnipresent or omnipotence does not mean he can do things that will violate his nature.
Right.
Right? So he cannot lie, he cannot sin, he cannot deny himself.
Right.
These are things he cannot do.
Right.
Does that make God not omnipresent? Or I keep doing that. Not omnipotent? No, not in the sense of the definitions that we're bound by, which are scriptural.
Right.
Right. And God cannot violate his own being.
Right. And translating that to us, you know, we've been told that we can do all things through Christ.
Sorry. Yep, and I can throw a perfect spiral 100 yards, right?
Yeah. So can you, right?
I can't.
Can you throw a perfect spiral 100 yards?
No. I can barely throw a spiral. But the text is not saying I should be able to.
Right. Because God has given us the authority and the power to do the things he has commanded us to do. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, gives me that ability to do it. But it's only within the parameters of God's will, mm-hmm. of God's design, of, you know,
and of being human,
right?
And a man, right? In our day and age, that's being violated all over the
place. Oh, absolutely.
Right? So, I mean, men cannot get pregnant.
That is true.
That is a true statement, but that is being spoken of in different terms today in order to violate all these created orders.
The breakdown of true reality in that God has created is astonishing, mm-hmm. to see how prevalent it's become that people who innocently are actually being very confused right now.
Because there are many who are not innocently trying to.
Right, exactly. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But for a Christian, if God has given you a task to do, he will give you the authority and the power to do it. The ability. He strengthens us to do something. We might, you know, we think of power and as like Superman, you know, lifting cars and throwing them at people. That kind of power. But the power is different here. It has to do with ability, and it has to do with seeing God's purposes done through us. In that God has graciously allowed finite man to be part of the building of his kingdom is astonishing. And yet he's chosen to do this. And so we will have the power, we will have the ability that God needs for us to have to make his will done.
Well, thanks again for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. We are a podcast of the Reformed Forum, and you can find us at reformedforum.org. And if you want to find out more about the congregation that Rob and I serve, you can go to westminsteropc.org. Or for more OPC congregations within the Chicagoland area, you can go to chicagoreformed.org. Rob, what's up next time?
Next time we're going to kind of tone it down, talk about something easy, the Trinity.
All right. Once again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.